Support for this program comes from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Our show's regular host, Matt Curtis, is across the pond in London town right now, so he asked if your friendly neighborhood Negro would step in for him once again. Hello, my name is Max Fuller, a.k.a. Bamax Obama, and welcome back to Radio K's Real College Podcast. Today's show is all about one of our longtime producers, Aaron Bolton, as he is graduating and leaving us to move on to bigger and better things. We're going to take a look back at a couple of stories Aaron's done for us and talk to him about his time here at the Real College Podcast. You might laugh, you might cry, you might end up wanting to buy medical marijuana. I don't know. All I know is that it starts right here on the Real College Podcast. This is Max Fuller, a.k.a. the Maxillennium Falcon, a.k.a. Hayao Maxazaki, and I'm in the studio with
Aaron Bolton
and Patrick Sharkey.
Did you create that one right after Star Wars, the new Star Wars?
The Maxillennium Falcon?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good. I thought it was fitting.
That's good.
Very timely. Very timely Max name.
Yeah. Topical.
Yeah, very topical. We're in the studio remembering our dear friend Aaron as he is venturing off into the abyss of the quote unquote real world.
Yeah, the real
he's
world.
Not dead.
Yeah,
he's not dead yet.
I mean, I hope I'm not dead. Yeah. At least I'm unaware of it.
We're all dead, man. Nobody's alive. So we're going to hear a couple of past stories from Aaron. What is the first story about?
Right, the first one we do security breach.
Yeah, security breach.
Yeah. So, basically, a friend of mine's father's computer got hijacked by a guy. Obviously, we don't know who. And basically, just kind of talking about the risks that we all take, and kind of some of it can be unavoidable sometimes. So just some preventative things you can do for kind of the new world that we live in with computers.
How in, well, 2016, I was about to say 2015. How in 2016 can people still do this kind of stuff to your computer? You would think that they would have, like, built-in security measures for this kind of stuff at this point.
We do for viruses and stuff, but now the game is all about getting you to accidentally click on something that, since you clicked on it, you're allowing it to happen. So it's all about disguising, it sounds like it's just mostly emails. If I remember correctly, what Brian Dillon was saying, it's just everything. It's not even computer hijacking. A lot of these things are coming through emails that are disguised. They look like they're coming from your coworker. They look like they're coming from, people, and these people figure these things out and they get you to click on a link. And the really scary thing is, you can click on a link today and your computer can get hijacked like 2 years from now.
That
person can be just sitting there just waiting to press that button.
Waiting for you to get your bank account up.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. And and with computer hijacking, they're not really stealing your information. They're just extorting money from you by holding it hostage. So it's they're just, there are always different ways to kind of cause mayhem on your personal computer. Yeah, and I think the streaming kind of revolution is forcing some of these attackers to do things in new ways, because I used to download stuff all the time as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's all about streaming. So I don't download things like I used to. And so now that the P2P sharing programs like LimeWire and FrostWire and all those.
Oh, the golden days.
rest in peace, Napster. But, those things are kind of disappearing. I know people that still use those things.
Well, and torrents, too. Torrents are definitely more popular now, but mm-hmm. you still run that risk of anything could be in those torrents. They're not, people don't check them necessarily.
No, not at all.
One of the things I really like about your stories, Aaron, is like how current your stories tend to be. You kind of touch on current events, which is, I think it's kind of cool because you turn it around pretty quick, and I think that's something that like the podcast really benefits from. Do you look for stories like that in particular? You've got like the hacking one and medical marijuana, which we'll talk about in a little bit. Is that something you strive to do? Is it get more current things?
Yeah, my story, all my stories ideas when I like started this job were all just looking into different scenes around Minneapolis. Because when I started, I desperately wanted to be like a music reporter professionally, and then I saw that hope dwindle.
Most music reporting is kind of trash.
Tough
right
to
now.
Do.
Yeah. It's hard to have real substance there, real credibility.
Right.
But anyways, yeah. No. As I started kind of to fall in love with news a little bit more. And that was the last thing you could, I mean, man, if we could have my parents on there, it'd be like the last thing they ever thought I'd be doing in the world would be like news reporting. But as I fell in love with that, that's what I kind of wanted to do, is try to be more timely and to kind of figure out. And sometimes I would almost purposely procrastinate to like force myself to turn it around a little bit faster.
Yeah.
Just because, I don't know, it seems like those guys in the real world, they're putting those 4-minute pieces together in a day.
Right.
And so it's like, man, gotta get those skills up. So,
yeah.
All right, well, let's listen to Aaron's story about security breaches.
Tonight, new concern about a security breach, this time at Home Depot.
Target hit with a huge security breach.
The word security breach. It has become part of our vocabulary over the past few years in light of large-scale attacks on corporations. They are described as
alarming security breach,
massive security breach,
the largest cyber attacks in U.S. history.
And it could be bigger than the breach at Target.
They may make you nervous about your personal information, but it can be easy to forget about the variety of techniques hackers ploy to wage cyber warfare one person at a time. The person behind the other screen may not be stealing your identity, but instead wants you to pay them using
a fairly new thing that's occurring in our environment.
This is Brian DeLynn, Chief Information Officer at the University of Minnesota, and he's talking about computer hijacking.
You hear it called things like CryptoLocker and stuff. Basically, it's somebody has some piece of malware that encrypts the drive and makes it unreadable, unless you have the key.
The primary target of an attack like this isn't your personal information, it's your money.
A banner came across, and it was not a GUI interface. It was like the old machine language, I guess you'd call it. It just said that if you want these files to open up, you must pay $1,000, and it gave some instructions on how to transfer money to this place. My name is Raleigh Matson. I'm a 61-year-old male who looks much older than that.
Matson is a sales representative for a large computer distributor who works from home. And his work computer was hijacked a few months ago.
Did you lose all your files, or are your files stored on the cloud storage?
I didn't think it was necessary for me because I'm that clever. So I lost everything except for in my email things. You know, there are things that the company backs up, but the personal files, they were just gone.
Matson has seen just about every major change in the computer industry.
I have known since day one to back things up. I sell computers every day for 40 years. I tell people one thing. Back up your stuff.
How someone like him can get put into a position like this, it's hard to pinpoint.
I said yes to somebody. I accepted something. You know, I probably get in a day, business-related, specific to me, 200 emails. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm copied on things, that kind of thing. If you catch 5,000 of your emails, no problem. But the 5,000 first is a problem. That's what it is.
Okay, so far you've heard terms like encrypt, virus, and malware. To make this straightforward, here's how it goes. The hacker attaches malicious software known as malware to link generally sent through email. So for someone like Matson, who gets 200 emails a day, it can be difficult to always have your guard up. The victim clicks on the link and the malware is installed onto the device. The malware then has the ability to lock up your hard drive, the piece of hardware that stores all your information on your computer.
If you spam a million people, some insignificant small part are going to send the money back, because it costs nothing to spam 100 people, is no less than spamming 100 million people. It's a pretty ingenious thing to do, and most of it begins with a belief in Russia.
It can be easy to think of the person on the other side as this sophisticated hacker across the world, but Matson cyber attacker could have been his next-door neighbor using malware purchased off the internet.
They're just using malware that's out there, that's available. They're not often creating it themselves. They're buying something.
And these pieces of software don't always do the same thing.
It all depends on the type of malware that they've put involved, and the ones that you were describing earlier.
I had explained to him earlier what had happened in Madsen's case.
Generally the ones that they're completely locking the entire drive versus they may be locking some piece of information instead. But it all depends on the malware that they've used.
Because there's such a variety of malware used, it makes it even harder to understand how it happened to you. Some forms of malware give its user the ability to launch their attack at a time they choose. So if you clicked on the link 2 months ago, you may not even remember it.
It could be months, it could be a year, it could be, you know, a long time.
Once it's happened, there's not a whole lot you can do. And as for Madsen's computer?
I sent it back and it was destroyed. They didn't want to take the risk of looking at the drive and that thing. They just destroyed it.
Dylan says the best thing you can do to fight computer hijacking is to back your stuff up to a place not connected to your computer.
I don't fear it. I mean, it's a fact of life. I mean, I guess you could worry about everything unless you go off the grid and turn your machine off. You're open to that.
As computers continue to creep into our lives, so do the issues they bring with them. It's Murphy's Law. If it can go wrong, it will. For Culture Q, I'm Aaron Bolton.
All right, we're back in studio. This is OptiMax Prime, a.k.a. Max Fuller, and I'm here with
Aaron Bolton.
Patrick Sharkey.
And we're talking about Aaron's next story now, which is about Tim Kaiser, a noise musician. Tell us about that a little bit, Aaron.
Tim has been around for quite some time. He's a Duluth musician that's been around in the Duluth scene, particularly for, at least a couple decades, I believe. And Tim started out just like any other old-fashioned musician, just learned guitar from his grandfather and went on to start a punk band. And then he ended up with noise. He said he ended up there because he would, in a punk band, obviously, you don't have a whole lot of money. In any band, you really don't have a whole lot of money. Mm-hmm. So he was the go-to guy to fix all their broken equipment. And so he got really good at fixing electronic equipment. And got into this thing that's known as circuit bending, which essentially is what a lot of noise musicians do. They modify guitar pedals. They make their own things. It's anything from putting your voice through a distortion pedal to getting pickups on random objects that can make quirky noises and to get those noises picked up electronically. So Tim started making his own instruments. And as you will hear in the story, I kind of get a small description of them, but they're mostly these really strange wooden boxes. They actually look pretty elegant, actually, and they have all these knobs and switches on them. And Kaiser, they all, you know, they're anything from delays, which he has a lot of. He'll have a lot of droning noises. And so as he's on stage, more so sitting on stage with his equipment, and there's all kind of crazy lights and all these things, and he makes these things, and they've actually become sought after. People want to buy these things, and so he'll sell them in order to fund some of his projects. And so people really want these instruments. And he makes that open frame Kodo thing, and it's like this spherical thing with these strings, and it's got snowmobile parts on it, all kinds of crazy stuff. So he makes electronics to hardwired, you know, instruments.
Are a lot of the instruments like unique? Does he make multiple iterations of like the same instrument, or is it like this is the instrument
For like the open frame Kodo thing? I don't think he's made a whole lot of those.
Okay.
I've seen what he sells a lot are these thumb pianos, which they've been around forever. I mean, they're just these small little wooden things with these metal strips coming out them at different lengths, and you just kind of let them flick off. You press them down and let them flick up, and they, because of the different lengths of the metal, they make different tones. But okay. He puts a like a guitar pickup, like a quarter-inch cable in the back of that, and that can be hooked up into all his other gadgets and stuff. Oh, so, I don't even know how to describe it, but the first sound you hear as I'm describing the individual sounds in the story, I believe that's a thumb piano hooked up to one of his delays that he made.
Sweet.
And so, yeah, people buy these things, and then he'll only make them for a limited time, so they're kind of... they're unique, they're handcrafted, and it's just kind of an interesting thing he gets to share with his fans.
How did he first start making these things? Did somebody teach him, or is it just kind of something that he... ventured into by himself.
Like I said earlier, he just kind of learned a lot of this stuff through fixing his band's equipment when he was in a punk band with his brother. And so their equipment would break down, and he would learn to fix a lot of these things. But then he'd also start figuring out how to modify them just through doodling and fixing and just kind of making sure they could produce music at their next show.
Yeah.
Just punk all the way until he became a noise musician. And he also said he kind of fell into noise because his brother was a lot better guitar player than he was. And so he kind of had to find his own gimmick in order to have his say in the musical family, I guess.
Well, sounds like a pretty funky dude, man.
Yeah, he is a funky dude.
Let's listen to Aaron's story and see what Tim Kaiser's talking about.
What you're hearing is a song called Earth by
Tim Kaiser, and I'm a musician, a composer and performer, and I build all of my own instruments.
As you can hear, Kaiser's music is not exactly what you would hear on, say, the radio. Well, until now. His music is interesting, but even more peculiar are the instruments and equipment he composes these songs on.
This particular thing, it's made from water pipe and turnbuckles, and that's a snowmobile drive gear. And I have these little like Suzuki tuners so that you can tune it up however you want.
Kaiser is describing what he calls an open frame Kodo, a string bass instrument that looks like it came straight out of Frankenstein's laboratory.
It's alive! It's alive! It's alive!
But Kaiser's creations aren't reinventing the wheel. He says there just aren't a lot of people
running around playing this thing.
His open frame Kodo is a replica of a Japanese instrument.
That one's like shaped like this, but it actually has a big fingerboard, and they're made out of wood.
Kaiser manipulates sound with his handmade effects circuits, housed in small little wooden boxes with buttons, knobs, and switches protruding all over them. He combines, loops, and layers various stored samples and the sounds from his instruments.
When you're stacking notes or stacking frequencies, say, you know, your first note is going like this fast and the second note is going, you know, this fast, somewhere in between they're going to overlap and create this third sound that doesn't exist anywhere else except when you combine those first two sounds.
He's creating his music based upon a principle of hearing known as beating.
You can kind of think of it like an orchestra tuning.
This is Joe Hins, a University of Minnesota grad student studying audiology.
If you have two violin players and they're trying to be in tune with one another, if they're slightly out of tune, let's say, you know, one is producing a note that's 440 hertz and another is producing a frequency of 444 hertz, the difference of those two frequencies is also going to be heard, so you're going to hear that 4 hertz as a third tone.
Kaiser has a different term.
You know, I'm always kind of looking for that kind of ghost sound, I guess is what it is.
This is the simplest way to put how Kaiser builds his music.
Yeah, I build layers, basically, sonic layers of different things. I start with kind of a bass or a bed of something that I really like maybe just a drone like that might be the bed. And then I start, you know, manipulating things through delays and whatnot and stacking on top.
So while Kaiser's ghost tones do have scientific principle behind them, it's a lot more complicated when you start hearing something like this. Then there's this. This. And this, all creating a river of sounds that our brain can't possibly process at once.
The inner ear is considered a non-linear system.
So when your ear takes in more than two tones at once, which is the case with about every sound we encounter, we don't
process those two tones in themselves. There's more processing that happens aside from those two tones.
Not only does Kaiser like to play with the way we hear tones in the search for his ghost sound, but he takes his sonic layering technique a step further in his new project, Inferior Planets.
It's a double 7-inch So there's two discs, four sides.
Each of the four songs, Helios, Mercury, Venus, and Earth, were constructed to be played simultaneously, ready for you to layer and manipulate them right in your own home. Granted, you have two turntables. Although it'd be much more fun playing with vinyl, Kaiser was kind enough to provide the project in digital form. You're listening to Helios, the track he says the whole project rides on. Let's play the track Earth Over the Top. Whether you like ambient noise music or not, the concepts Tim Kaiser seems to be playing with are even more intriguing when he puts the power in the listener's hands. For Culture Q, I'm Aaron Bolton.
So Aaron, what is this third story that you picked from the archives about?
The third story is one of my more newsy stories, I guess I did while I was here. It's about medical marijuana in Minnesota when it first came out on July 1st of 2015. It's kind of, I have to get used to saying that. I just like register that it's 2016 now. I guess it's some more recent developments. At this time when medical marijuana is out for about a month, the rollout didn't go quite as smooth as the two companies that are allowed to produce medical marijuana in the state thought. Not enough people were being able to be registered. Doctors were very reluctant to register patients out of fear for their own careers. And a lot of people were having difficulties qualifying under the nine conditions that were qualifying conditions. Prices since then have gone way up. I've talked to a bunch of people doing other stories that they're going back to the black market. I've heard of people starting to sell marijuana coming from other states that are sick to other sick people. So kind of creating a medical marijuana black market. So I've heard people talk about that. Far as, you know, actual proof of that, you know, it's kind of hard to let people, you know, show you their underground weed deals. So that was kind of the climate. And now they have kind of a new boost of hope. The medical commissioner is added intractable pain.
That was a big problem with it the first time around, right?
Yes. Yeah. They didn't include tractable pain. And Minnesota lawmakers were fearing intractable pain specifically because it is such a wide range ailment. And the big issue is that a lot of patients say that opiates don't really help them. They don't actually get rid of their pain. And a lot of these people end up becoming addicted. Mm-hmm. And that can lead to other things like, you know, heroin use, you know, and overdoses. There's said to have been a lot of suicides. So medical marijuana in other states for intractable pain has kind of been the number one choice. And so Minnesota lawmakers seem to kind of had feared becoming another Colorado. And that's what they kind of feared. So
what do you think the future of marijuana in Minnesota is, medically, recreationally, just in general?
I mean, far as recreationally, I think we'll see that nationally before we'll see that in Minnesota specifically. You know, and I think we'll probably see that in the next maybe 30 years or so, maybe 50, maybe even longer. I think a lot of people had hope when Colorado went recreational. But once again, I think the pot of conservatives on that issue specifically,
no pun intended,
yeah, kind of stirred the pot, and I think we kind of realized how many people hadn't really been vocal about not supporting that specifically. So it's changing, it's fluctuating, but I think it's progressing, and I guess we'll see where it goes.
So you could say that the future is a little hazy.
It is a little hazy with our weed puns.
All right, well, let's listen to that story.
Minutes before midnight struck, bringing in the month of July, 48-year-old Patrick McClellan stood waiting outside Minnesota Medical Solutions in Minneapolis. He was said to be one of the three very first patients to enter one of eight medical marijuana dispensaries spread throughout Minnesota.
It's surreal. And I'm trying to hold back the emotion until this is over, but I don't know if I'm going to be able to do that. You know, I'm trying to prevent the tears from flowing because I know they will. So.
McClellan qualifies for the program under a rare form of muscular dystrophy,
called mitochondrial myopathy, which consists of severe and violent muscle spasms.
And despite the 30 pills McClellan takes on a daily basis, he still suffers from violent muscle spasms that can leave him helpless.
When I have an attack, what I'm supposed to do is to chew up these two medications,
which the FDA says could kill him when he takes these medications this way. And McClellan says they take about 10 minutes to work. But when he uses marijuana to treat an attack, which he's been doing for years now, it's a different story.
So when I have an attack, one small puff off a vaporizer will stop muscle spasms almost immediately.
McClellan has been fighting for legal access to medical-grade marijuana since 2012. And now that his relief is here, that's not the case for everyone. Minnesota's medical marijuana program is one of the more conservative programs in the country.
The language of the law, what passed and was enacted, is a lot more restrictive than what we would like to see in Minnesota. My name is Robert Kopecky. I'm the Deputy Director of State Policies at the Marijuana Policy Project.
The Marijuana Policy Project is a national organization that fights for reform on marijuana laws at the state and federal level. Kopecky says there's a lot more work to be done here in Minnesota. To give a basic rundown of where the law stands now, patients can only qualify under 9 chronic illnesses, which include cancer, glaucoma, HIV/AIDS, Tourette syndrome, ALS, seizures, severe muscle spasms, Crohn's disease, and terminal illness with life expectancy under 1 year. And unlike many medical states, Minnesota only allows oils, pills, and tinctures as delivery methods for patients. And these meds can only be bought from 2 manufacturers, Minnesota Medical Solutions and Leaf Line Labs. Being their only 8 locations, distance is an issue. 31-year-old Andrew Stoll of Marshall, Minnesota, would have to make a 2.5-hour drive to St. Cloud to access the nearest dispensary. But, like many people who qualify, Stoll isn't just facing the distance issue.
Unfortunately, none of the doctors I've found, Aaron, are really wanting to prescribe it. So many doctors right now are afraid of the professional repercussions of the prescription.
Doctors do not prescribe marijuana themselves. They just register patients who can then go access a doctor and pharmacist at a dispensary, which creates a legal buffer. Kopecky says doctors' reluctance to participate in new medical marijuana states is relatively normal.
The medical communities are trained under, you know, a specific, scholastic regimen that we will be put into. The medical school model is very particular and, very, I guess, FDA medication-approved focus. So there is some reluctance that we see in doctors in the medical marijuana states.
Nonetheless, Minnesota's rollout is moving slowly. Out of 334 doctors registered, only 475 patients have been registered throughout the state. About half of those patients still are awaiting further approval to actually pick up a prescription. For people like Stoll, who are still struggling to get started, hope is not all lost.
I'm not pessimistic about this. I'm very hopeful about things that are happening. The wheels of government are very slow turning.
The program's unexpected struggle to firmly establish itself has manufacturer Minnesota Medical Solutions raising prices on their prescriptions. McClellan, who we heard from at the beginning of the story, may not be able to afford his newfound legal access.
It went from $47 for the preloaded vaporizer cartridge to now $66. For that same cartridge.
That $19 increase has put McClellan in a tough spot.
I estimate using 3 pens a month, but at the current price now, I can't afford that. I would be only able to get 2 pens. And I think what the problem is going to be is if, you know, even at this price or if the price gets raised, it will not be affordable for almost anybody.
Minnesota Medical Solutions CEO Kyle Kingsley told the Associated Press more patients used a low-income discount than expected, forcing the company to spread out costs. And enrollment numbers in the program make it hard to save on mass production cost.
But the main issue is that now I think what's going to end up happening is you're going to have people that cannot afford the medications that are now already certified. So you will have people that will buy minimum amounts or whatever they can afford and then have to supplement with cannabis off the street.
I reached out to Leafline Labs to see if they were also raising prices, and CEO Manny Munson-Regala said they have no plans on raising prices in the near future. But when insurance does not cover medical marijuana, and for McClellan and other Minnesota Medical Solution patients, the price increase hits hard. As for now, patients must bide their time and hope for relief. For the Real College Podcast, I'm Aaron Bolton.
From all of us over here at Radio K, I'd like to say thank you to Aaron for all the work that he's done here, and good luck out there in the real world. You can find us on iTunes, RadioK.org, and on air Sundays at 6 p.m. on Radio K. Support for this program comes from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, and thank you for listening. Peace, love, and hair grease, y'all. I'm out.